to another edition of Thinking Like a Lawyer.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Great. I'm glad.
I'm also glad that all these listeners are here.
That's true. I'm Joe Patrice. I'm from Above the Law, as is Catherine Rubino, who keeps talking, even though she hasn't been introduced yet. But now she has
been.
Sorry,
am I supposed to wait for an invitation from you?
It's not an invitation. It's, you know, me making a grand entrance.
Sometimes you have to assert yourself, man.
I mean, if you want to do the beginning of the show always, you can do it.
Absolutely not. I much prefer to annoy you with it.
See, I'm not annoyed by it anymore.
You just decided.
I've decided I'm not.
Because I think that twitch in your eye says otherwise.
There's no twitch. So let's jump right into small talk. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you do anything fun this weekend?
I can't even remember. I don't think so.
Well, I did some gardening.
Oh, that's nice.
That was, not really fun, but, you know, productive. So I guess that counts.
Growing anything interesting?
No. Mostly killing weeds is what
I was killing
doing.
Things.
So, but when I say things like gardening, it sounds like, you know, it was a cute little hobby. If I say weeding, the implication is that I've, you know, let the garden go to pot and now I need to clean it up, which is way more accurate.
But fair enough.
Not necessarily the image that I wish to project into the world. So, you know. Oh, that's not true. The other fun thing I did was listen to the new Lizzo album.
Oh, yeah? How's that?
Yeah. Oh, I really like it.
Good.
Really, really like it. Birthday Girl so far is my favorite. But, you know, I think the more you listen to it, you get different favorites. But on the initial few dozen listenings of the album, I really enjoyed Birthday Girl.
Yeah, that's something I did. I continue my quest to get good at making homemade pizza by making homemade pizza. So, and I actually...
So it means you also ate some pizza, huh?
I did. Well, and I managed to get the, you know, so... Personally, I prefer when pepperoni is that cool kind of pepperoni that like curves up and makes like little cups filled with like grease, whatever.
I know they market it that way.
Yeah. Well, so I've been buying the like version that's marketed that way, but I managed to make it myself using a stick. You just got to slice it super thin, but I was able to get...
Your knife skills are improving, I guess.
I have a mandolin slicer now, so
it's like a professional tool, so it still counts.
Yeah.
I think that it was like, I think it was like Pizzeria Uno used to have this pepperoni pizza where they would have like the thin little slices, but then they would also like chunk up pepperoni into
I've seen chunk up,
like, but it's like chunk up with the curly kind.
Ooh, interesting.
And it was like, so like, you know how the curly ones, especially when it's on top, they can get a little like crispy and almost like lose some of the pepperoniness. But you had like the chunky ones underneath that really gave you that bite of pepperoni along with the crisp on top. Something for you to consider for your future in pizza making. If this whole blogging thing doesn't work out for you.
Fair enough.
Or podcasting.
All right. Well, I think with that, we can put a stop to the small talk.
Are you waiting for me to? I thought that was it.
Yeah.
I did think you were just waiting to irritate me.
Hey.
But I'm going to take a note from your book.
And you're not going to be bothered by it anymore.
Doesn't bother me anymore.
Yeah, see, there we go.
I'm lying. Just so we're clear.
So this is actually one of those instances where we already had previewed this last week, and we're going to, you know, make good on what we fulfill, what we, you know, it's payoff.
For our regular listeners, congratulations. So, you get a little payoff.
So last week we laid out, you know, the Chekhov's gun of, well, I guess, Elon's gun in this instance, that Elon Musk was about to get sued by
Twitter.
He sure
did.
Elon Musk has now been sued by Twitter. And a lot has happened in that case that's of note. So we got to see the complaint. There's a Above the Law story about it that you can read in detail, of course, breaking down the complaint. But the general takeaway from the complaint is it's not looking great for old Elon.
Well, I mean, in fairness, I think from day two after they announced the deal, were saying, I think he's trying to get out of the deal.
Yeah, within moments he was getting out.
Which doesn't bode well for, you know, good faith efforts by one party to a deal. Without knowing the specifics, that is certainly something that jumps out to me, at least initially.
Yeah, so the problem, I think, coming at this from a litigation perspective, which obviously I'm not a M&A lawyer, though I feel as though I'm getting
some... You play one on TV?
No, I feel like I'm getting some good apprenticeship in deal making, though, just by covering this story. In fact, I've been hearing from M&A lawyers who've been writing back channel to me about my stories that I'm getting everything pretty much right. So that's nice. Good to know that nice. I'm able to figure this stuff out.
Again, if this whole blogging thing doesn't work out for you.
Right, I could be a lawyer or something like I was before. Anyway, so...
You weren't an M&A lawyer.
That's true. Anyway, I think the more damning lines from this, it can really come down to, there's one line in the complaint that I really enjoyed where Twitter says, the agreement was negotiated through the night and, in the process, became even more seller-friendly. That's never a good place to begin if you're the buyer going to court. This agreement was apparently requested by Ivan to be seller-friendly because he wanted to get it done immediately. Then they negotiated it overnight, and it became more seller-friendly, including explicitly agreeing to specific performance if the deal started to not be done, basically agreeing that the courts of Delaware are allowed to force him to buy Twitter if he...
Ruh-roh.
Yeah. He also... waived his rights to due diligence.
See, that's the one that gets me.
Yeah, so
it's stunning. And obviously, Elon has been on Twitter complaining about bots basically since he decided, since the value of Tesla kind of tanked, right? These are not unrelated facts. But one of the things that, one of the details of this very seller-friendly agreement is that he waives all due diligence. And I'm like, well, then I don't see your complaint.
Yeah, so theoretically, he would have the right to dig into a series of aspects of Twitter's business to make sure that what he's buying is what he wants. He decided, in the interest of getting the deal done quickly, that he didn't care about any of that. Now, obviously, he needs to find a way out. There is a provision that says that if there's some materially adverse condition that the company is basically broken and lying and defrauding people, that he could get out. He's attempting to argue that the incidents of fake spam accounts are much bigger than Twitter says they are. Twitter says they're around 5%. He asserts that they're much bigger than that.
There's no evidence behind there said assertion, correct?
Correct. There's no evidence.
So, it's not super
compelling. Asked the company to provide him proof. They provided him, according to the complaint, a detailed document explaining how they calculate this. He later, according to the complaint, admits that he never read this document.
It's not a good fact.
After asking for it. Yeah. They have this number. They say it's around 5%. He says it's not. But the crux is what seems to be lacking from all conversation from the Tesla bros about this is that it's not enough to say, aha, gotcha, it was really 6% or something like that, because that is not a material change to Twitter's business model. He's got to be coming up with the idea that this is
75%,
yeah, like 50-60% or something like that, probably. Yeah. I mean, even if he were able to get to 15%, that would be questionable whether or not that's material, but at least it's in the ballpark. But right now, his big complaint, and we've seen since the original complaint came out, he hasn't answered this complaint yet, but...
Sure.
But the complaint was...
Given time, according to...
Well, the complaint also included a motion to expedite the trial and basically go to trial in the fall. He wants to push this to 2023, so he wrote a answer to that motion, which will be heard this week. That answer to the motion is not about the case in chief, but does give us a preview of his theories in the case in chief. And he really leans into Twitter didn't use any AI for some reason to calculate how many bots there were, but instead took a random sample and used that.
That's how statistics work. I'm no math whiz, but that is my understanding of statistics.
That is how statistics work. And interestingly, he leans into in this answer that, they only took 0.00005% of the total. And like,
that seems like a lot.
It's a small amount, but you know, in the world of statistics, if you're pulling a truly random sample, it's been many years since I've had to do this, since my economics degree as an undergrad. I had to do a lot of stats. And so I haven't done a lot of it lately, but I was able to dust off my skills and do a little bit of calculating. And it worked out that that probably results in, I don't know, around 1% margin of error. So maybe.
So not material?
Maybe Twitter has 6% bots, not 5.
Not
material. Or maybe
not
they have 4.
4, right.
Somewhere in there.
Oh, okay. Here's. Maybe I'm being silly, but why is this statistical mechanism relevant for the question of whether or not there's an expedited trial?
Well, it's not. I say it's not. His argument for why it is that the only way to get to the truth would require massive and intensive factual and expert discovery about what the proper method is and get a bunch of data and whatever, which it doesn't, because he's of this mind that the only way to figure out how many bots there are
is to interview every Twitter user.
He wants to build some like algorithm that is constantly always looking at all 300 million or whatever accounts to figure out what's going on, which is just lunacy to get that deep when you can use stats like we do for everything else.
Also, two things strike me as absolute killers to this argument. The first we've already discussed, right, which is it definitely does not require physically counting or doing some creating new algorithm because you literally said no due diligence. But also, the mechanism by which Twitter calculates its bots ratio has been disclosed in all of its public filings.
Right.
So this is known. So he should have known, or his lawyers certainly knew, if he personally didn't, certainly knew that this is how Twitter has said that it has calculated bots since they started disclosing it, however many years ago.
There's
been numerous filings filed with the government, with the SEC, that explicitly says this is how we calculate it.
Right. So, and this goes to the question whether or not there's actual factual or expert discovery needed. Mm-hmm. The question that's really on the table is, did Twitter perform the tests it said it did,
right,
and did those tests yield the results they say they did? And as long as that's true, that should end the inquiry.
Yeah.
The question of whether or not there's some other way they could be testing is really immaterial. Mm-hmm. Immaterial, I meant not as a term of art, but also as a term of art in this case. It's really bad. The one thing they do say in their motion against the expedited trial, the one thing they do say there that may help and actually may get them over the hump on that specific question is that Twitter's argument is this needs to be done by the fall because the merger agreement terminates in October, but there is a clause saying that it's stayed if there's litigation. So that may be enough to push the trial a little bit later. But the idea that this trial has to be pushed because of how complex it is just
wild.
It suggests nobody understands statistics over there, which is a problem.
Or it's just their best argument. So sometimes you advance arguments as a lawyer that you know are unlikely to be winners.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You say that's their best argument, but I saw an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal from some law professors.
I was going to say, it sounds to me like this is a slam dunk legal argument for Twitter.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's so weird. This Wall Street Journal op-ed by some law professors said that it was obvious that Musk was going to win. Really impressive. Yeah, because then I read it and, It's bad.
So your argument is that the Wall Street Journal op-ed was
disingenuous and wrong. What a shock! Especially last week, given that they had a bad week at their op-ed page. they got disproven in real time last week multiple times. But the argument. It just hurts
okay.
my head.
It's okay. You can tell it me what the bad man did
so,
to you.
So these professors started saying, well, I mean, there's no way there could be specific performance here. Putting aside that's agreed to explicitly in the merger agreement.
I mean, that's a pretty big thing to put
aside.
Which
is pretty big. But as our former colleague, the former deal breaker, one of Above the Law's companion sites, but formerly of deal breaker, now of Bloomberg, as Matt Levine put, he took like 10 seconds, was able to come up with multiple cases in Delaware, under Delaware law, where specific performance was ordered. Indeed, the judge who's assigned to this case has already done it in the past. it's just bad. And they make some arguments about
you seem flummoxed.
It was a little disconcerting to read, because it was as though they hadn't bothered to do the basics of that sort of research. So they make this convoluted argument that because shareholders aren't a party to this lawsuit, that means that if they don't order specific performance, which they say they can't, but they can, if they don't do that, there's no way to create monetary damages, because it would go to the company and not to the shareholders. But that's not even true in Delaware. They've done that in Delaware law. What they do is they just
order.
You pay the company, and they're ordered to give it to the share. Like, it was thrown together
in order to capitalize on headlines.
Maybe it is difficult.
I mean, it's the only article that I've certainly seen about the merger that suggests that Twitter's not going to win,
yeah.
Right? So it gets a little bit of hot takey kind of, you know.
It felt very ESPN hot take show, sort of, you know.
It's like the Jason Wilbon of M&A.
Yeah, exactly. No, I will say, in their defense, the professors did write me on Friday night to explain. It was a Friday night or Saturday night? Well, one of these nights, they wrote me to explain their case and, you know, to give a detailed explanation of where they thought their case was making more sense or whatever. And by detailed explanation, they called me a douchebag, and that was the substance of
their... Well, I don't want to say that they're right about anything.
Okay, that's all right there.
Oh, come on. You got to give me that one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Come on.
Yeah, there's no attempt at actually substantively answering any of the issues.
It's hard when you're wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's hard to come up with answers when facts and the law are both
just not
go
on your side.
You.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's rough.
Anyway.
Won't you please think of the hot takers?
Yeah. I guess that's true. The hot take economy does deserve its help. Yeah. Anyway, so that's where
some
we sit.
Disingenuousness.
That's where we sit with Elon.
Yeah, that is where we are.
Generate quality briefs, memos, and redlines in minutes with Callidus AI. You enter the case's facts, then Callidus suggests bodies of law, statutes, and precedents. You tell it if those are relevant, and Callidus generates a well-cited, well-formatted document. You can trust what went into it because you put it there. Be exceptionally productive with better outcomes using Legal's most advanced AI platform. Just 3 minutes from registration to results. Get $90 off your first 2 months. Use promo code Joe at CallidusAI.com. That's CallidusAI.com.
Hey, Gee, what's up?
Just having some lunch, Conrad.
Hey, Gee, do you see that billboard out there?
Oh, you mean that guy out there in the gray suit?
Yeah, the gray suit guy.
Order up.
There's all those beautiful, rich, leather-bound books in the background.
That is exactly the one. That's J.D. McGuffin at law. He'll fight for you!
I bet you he has got so many years of experience.
Like decades and decades. And I bet, Gee, I bet he even went to a law school.
Are you a lawyer? Do you suffer from dull marketing and a lack of positioning in a crowded legal marketplace? Sit down with Guy and Conrad for Lunch Hour Legal Marketing on the Legal Talk Network, available wherever podcasts are found.
Okay, we're back. What else do we have going on this week?
I wrote about impeachment.
I mean, there's a term that, you know, you learned as a child and learned that it never comes up and has come up multiple times in my lifetime.
So many times in my lifetime. 3 times for president? It's
for
come
presidents,
up.
Yes.
For president,
but those aren't the only people who can be impeached.
No, it isn't. There's actually a Supreme Court justice that has already historically been impeached, Samuel Chase. But there was a letter written by a couple of Congress people, including AOC, saying that they wanted the Senate to make a finding a fact as to whether or not Justices Brett Kavanaugh and Neil Gorsuch lied to the Senate during their confirmation hearings about whether or not they would overturn Roe based on various statements that they made. And you know, that's all it kind of asks is that, you know, this kind of somebody lying in order to get a lifetime appointment cannot be tolerated, et cetera, et cetera. It does not go this further step, but certainly when I read it, the first thing I thought about is like, oh, they just want to tee up an impeachment vote, right? If there's a finding by the Senate that, yes, we believe these folks lied under oath, that seems to beg the House to have an impeachment vote. And listen, we've said on this podcast about previous impeachments that the most important thing about impeachment is your ability to count to 60. And there's zero chance that there are enough votes for removal that there'll ever be a former Justice Kavanaugh or Justice Gorsuch. But I also think that doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. You know, listen, the January 6th hearings are going on. They have been riveting. I think they have really done a tremendous job of showing what public spectacle looks like and why it's important to kind of change the conversation. Why shouldn't we drag Kavanaugh and Gorsuch through it? Make them be impeached. Make them have, you know, remembered by history as, you know, one of only three justices that have ever been impeached. Let's have Susan Collins justify why she won't actually remove the justices, despite now going on TV and being like, oh, I feel personally lied to, when we all knew that this was coming.
Yeah, I mean, she's either deeply cynical or the easiest mark in the world. I think it's deeply cynical.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, so I was on record as opposing the first Trump impeachment for that counting to 60 reason. And my logic was, he probably did obstruct justice, but if you're not going to get a conviction, what do you accomplish? I felt all you do is whip up his supporters into believing there's some sort of martyrdom and that it was all.
And of course, when he doesn't get removed, there's
right,
that.
Makes it
he's
seem
been vindicated.
Like he's yeah, exactly. So those were the reasons I was opposed to that. But in this instance, it's a little bit different, I think. Yeah. There's no way these people are going to be removed. But I think it accomplishes a few goals. I agree with you. I think it accomplishes a few goals that you wouldn't necessarily, as opposed to just removal. I mean, it does expose people like Collins to the fires of criticism that they absolutely deserve. But it also brings, I think, up the idea that the Supreme Court has devolved into being purely political. Putting aside what the results of this is, it would put them in the same seat as a Trump or a Clinton before of being impeached, which underscores the political nature of it, which I think is very important if you're somebody like me who thinks that we need to have term limits or other sorts of reforms, or even more extreme than me, but I understand, expanding the court. Like, if you want to make that case, a lot of the pushback to that case is, well, we shouldn't make the court be political.
The ship sailed.
Putting aside that the ship has sailed, if you drag people through a spectacle of pointing out that they lied under oath to Congress, you really are putting yourself in a position of saying, look, this has happened. The only hope is some more fundamental reform, which I think helps that position. So, yeah, I agree with you. I think that it's not a bad idea.
You know, a reader actually reached out to me after I wrote the article and wanted to know why Amy Coney Barrett was not included. And, you know, in the first instance, I'm like, well, that was the letter. I'm responding to what the letter said. The letter has those two justices specifically called out. But I think it's also because in some ways she's been a more cynical actor. If you recall, during the hearing, she said, oh, I don't know how I would rule on any abortion case. And I think my article at the time when that happened, I was like, yes, she does.
Right.
Yes, she does. She's lying. She's definitely, I know exactly how she's going to rule. So does she. But that's the kind of lie that you can't prove, right?
Yeah.
So I think she was way more cynical in her answers. And, you know, perhaps all this ever does is make any potential justice more cynical and more vague in their answers going forward. But none of which is a reason not to do this right now, in my mind.
Yeah, no, it does seem like it has benefits beyond the counting to 60 part. So, yeah, very interesting. So, yeah, so the last issue, you already kind of raised the rivetingness.
I think that's a word.
And whatever, it is now.
Yeah, there you go.
The
It is decided.
Yes, it is decided. So The rivetingness of the January 6th hearings, I wrote a little bit about this in a piece that, you know, I feel is more of a public service piece.
Yeah.
I don't know, as though, like, not a ton of people have necessarily read it yet, but those that have been reaching out and thanking me for it. I did a detailed breakdown of, it was part of the January 6th hearing, if you've been watching any of it. They have a lot of video clips of the testimony that they've taken, video depositions, you know, that's the way
that's
it works.
Thing.
And that's something that lawyers do all the time. They're also, and this is also a plug for court reporting services. Court reporting services are very much involved with videographers and building a system that gives you as a lawyer a good product to use. Mm-hmm. You can also, there's e-discovery outfits have, I know Everlaw, for instance, has a very lovely little AV editor that allows you to put together and sync up your video clips with the testimony and all. There's some slick stuff going on out there in this
world.
That is
not what Sidney Powell was doing, though.
Well, and this is my point. While there's all of this technology out there and work being done and the just prolific nature of video testimony, these hearings underscore that lawyers aren't, of all the actors thinking about this, lawyers are really asleep at the switch as far as what their witnesses look like on camera.
Yeah, I mean, well, at least some of them.
At least some of them, yes, that's fair. So I went through and did a detailed breakdown of all the different, not all, but I looked at all, and a healthy
Pick
selection.
Some highlights.
A healthy selection,
yeah,
of the video deposition
best and worst
testimony that we've already seen. And talk about the ways in which it is poorly framed and a disservice to the client to put them in this position.
Okay, like, so you've written about a lot of these. My question to you is, whose video setup was the absolute worst and why?
I feel like it, for different reasons, I feel like it's Bill Stepien's, where his lawyer is in the foreground taking up most of the screen and he's like the weirdly behind him testifying.
So okay, here's a question though. Is it actually bad though? If you're trying to kind of blend into
minimize
the scenery
yourself
and minimize your impact and you don't necessarily want this to be your digital footprint for forever, is it that bad?
Well, and that's the question. Was some of this being crazy like a fox and just saying, I'm going to create the worst possible framing for this video testimony so that nobody will ever use it in a serious way?
Well, I do think that, you know, I kind of mentioned Sidney Powell already, but her testimony, I mean, it looked terrible because it looked like it was from 1985. It was as choppy and as just awful background, awful everything, which I don't think is clever like a fox at all, or stupid like a fox or whatever. And the other one that I am not sure that they really thought about is former Above the Law columnist Kayleigh McEnany, which you delighted me with an Angel reference because,
oh, yeah. Old school,
old
school Wolfram and Hart reference. Yeah, no.
Which, if people did never watch the TV show Angel, was the law firm that was actually a evil. It was evil, and I think there was some sort of a hell mount that they opened up there.
Something like that. Well, it was so much like Kayleigh McEnany. Anyway, the point is her testimony was bizarre because it was almost it was in this super dark room with the curtains drawn and there were shadows everywhere. She looked weird in all the shadows, but her attorney behind her looked almost menacing. it was bad. I thought that was bad. I thought that the...
I mean, you never want someone's takeaway of the image of you to be evil, right?
Yeah.
That looked evil. Is not, if you're trying to be like, no, we did not try to take down the U.S. Republic, it's not a great look.
I mean, Ivanka and Jared both testified in, like, backed up against a marble wall, which looked like the simulacrum of classy, but in reality, it just looked like they were doing it from the lobby of a bad office building. Like, it, and why is your back to it? It was so weird. So many of these are terrible, there were a couple of good video ones, but the best ones, as one might expect, were people like Bill Barr, who you know, is a savvy operator who did it in person with the investigators so that he would be at the same table that they were. Mm-hmm. So he would be filmed in the same quality.
No difference in power dynamic, same quality.
Same quality video, same everything. Like that's the smart way to do it. Now, not everybody has that luxury, but if you aren't going to have that luxury, I implore you to take a second or two to think about what you look like. Anyway, so that happened. Cool. Yeah, that's pretty much everything for the week, isn't it?
It was a hell of a week. I'm sure there was a lot more, but that's our time, as they say.
Yeah. So thanks, everybody, for listening. You should subscribe to the show so you get them when they come out. You should give reviews, stars, write something. It's all good for us. You should be reading Above the Law so you can see these and other stories before we chat about them here. You should be following us on social media. I'm at Joseph Patrice. She's at Catherine One, the numeral
the
one. You should
one.
Also follow at ATL Blog, which is our official stream. You should listen to our other shows. She's the host of The Jabot. I'm a panelist on the Legal Tech Week Journalist Roundtable. There's a bevy of programs by the Legal Talk Network that we aren't on, but you should also be checking out. You should be, what else should you be doing? There's something else they should be doing. Anyway, I'm sure it'll come back to me at some
point.
Write
reviews?
Yeah, write reviews. I think I said that. Anyway, point is, you should do these things. They're great. I think that's it.
Peace.
If you're a lawyer running a solo or small firm and you're looking for other lawyers to talk through issues you're currently facing in your practice, join the Unbillable Hours Community Roundtable, a free virtual event on the third Thursday of every month. Lawyers from all over the country come together and meet with me, lawyer and law firm management consultant Christopher T. Anderson, to discuss best practices on topics such as marketing, client acquisition, hiring and firing, and time management. The conversation is free to join, but requires a simple reservation. The link to RSVP can be found on the Unbillable Hour page at LegalTalkNetwork.com. We'll see you there.